For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygen's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome.
Good evening.
I'm very happy to have tonight giving our talk Roy Wyman, who's our Ancient Dragon Zen Gate work leader and board member and long-time practitioner. So thank you very much, Roy, for speaking tonight.
Thank you for inviting me. So let me put my watch up here, because this is a long topic. And I'm a firm believer that anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. And I will not clearly have enough time to talk about the concept of self in one Dharma talk. So I'm going to do my best half-assed job at it. And you all can help me by asking intelligent questions and helping me out here. And I do think, though, that as I started to study this, I realized that I had not known how critical an element of the concept of self is traditionally within Buddhism, and how much of a central core of the Buddha's own teaching it was, until I really started to look at some of the early talks that he gave. And I will say that if I say anything that seems like it makes sense, I probably stole it from this great book by Joanna Macy, Mutual Causation in Buddhism and General Systems Theory. So if any of this sounds of interest to you, that's a modern take on it, and I think well worth reading. Anywhere where I go off track, it's because I probably wandered from this and from what the Buddha actually said. But you know, you can help me along the way as well. So let me start with this, an exercise. And you don't actually have to do it, but at least mentally think about this. If you were to point to a part of your body where yourself, that you, exists, where would you point to? Would you point? Most people in this country point to their heads, right about their temple. And that, I think it's a cultural thing. If you had asked an ancient Greek, he probably would have pointed to his chest, or she. Medieval Japanese person, maybe even today, probably point to their hara, which is getting easier for me to point to all the time. So we have, though, this idea of a self that's inside of our body somewhere. And most of us don't think of ourselves as residing somewhere in our fingertips or in the air around us. And this is kind of our personification, our living in this world where we are surrounded by what's called the pearl view of the self. That is, yourself is like a pearl. You can't really break it apart. It doesn't have component parts. It just is what it is. And we believe that we have this view of ourselves, that there's this pearl within us that's ourself. So Roy is residing somewhere in me. And, you know, I may do all these stupid things out there, and I may look like a dork, and my hair may be crazy today, but that's not the real Roy, clearly. Because Roy is, you know, much better looking, and eloquent, and people love Roy, I gotta tell you. Now, this doofus out here, it's mixed sometimes. Well, and if you go far enough with this, you get into what's called the homunculus view, which is, you know, a homunculus is sort of like a little you. So we have, you know, there's somewhere in me that I believe there's this little Roy sitting inside of my head that is kind of the real Roy, telling me what to do. And so what's actually seeing the world out there is this little homunculus in my head. Well, the problem is, obviously, that homunculus has to have a little homunculus inside of it, and pretty soon you get to a pretty small little homunculus inside the homunculus inside the homunculus. It doesn't really work very well. And the Buddha did not have this view, apparently, of the world. He was the first teacher that I know of that promoted a theory of self that was not a belief that there was a fixed, abiding, permanent self. There's no little Roy inside of me. And today, you can find philosophers who will argue one side or the other, but the truth is, in day-to-day life, Plato won. Plato said that there was this ideal realm out there, this sort of spiritual realm as we would think of it today, where you would have ideal forms. So there's this cup that looks a little bit different than any other cup, but there's some realm out there, an ideal realm, where there's the perfect cup. Nothing wrong with it. And every cup in this realm shares some aspect of that. And so too, we have a soul, and it shares in that ideal realm. It comes from that spiritual realm. And Plato believed this, and it got kind of into Christianity and other religions and sort of spread out. Whereas the Buddha taught what was called anatta. And I'm going to, you know, sometimes I'm going to use some words that are in Sanskrit, sometimes not. Don't ask me about language because I'm not good at it. But anatta is, I believe, the term which says that there really isn't this pearl, there isn't this abiding idealistic realm. Rather, all is mutually conditioned. Everything arises together. So what problem did the Buddha have with this ego theory, this theory of this pearl? Well, in one of his first discourses, it was called the Discourse on the Not-Self Characteristic. He really needs to come up with catchier names. He talks about the five skandhas. And you may know the five skandhas from the Heart Sutra: form, feeling, perception, formation, consciousness. And maybe before I get into it, Dave, could you do me a favor? Could you ring your bell once? So we all see the bell, we hear the bell, there are waves in the air from that bell. That's the form. Then we all have a reaction to it. You did that beautifully, by the way. And before I even knew, hey, that's the sound of a bell, I had a positive response to it. Sometimes I may have a negative, or I may have a neutral response. That's feeling. Perception is, hey, that's a bell, right? Formations then follow from that, which are impulses, all of our prejudices, all that karmic stuff that we've all grown up around, all the influences of our life that leads us this way or that. And then finally we have the mental formations of... No, I'm sorry, not finally. Next we have the impulses, perception formations, and then consciousness, which is we're actually aware that we're thinking. That sort of meta level. So the Buddha said, with regard to the self, form, monks, is not self. If form were the self, this form would not lend itself to dis-ease. It would be possible to say with regard to form, let this form be thus, let this form not be thus. But precisely because form is not self, form lends itself to dis-ease, and it is not possible to say with regard to form, let this form be thus, let this form not be thus. Feeling is not self. Perception is not self. Formations are not self. Consciousness is not self. And I'm cutting out some here. Thus, monks, any form whatsoever that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near, every form is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment as, this is not mine. This is not myself. This is not what I am. So what the Buddha has done here is he's taken all that you can say, you can take all of your thoughts, all of your cognition, all that goes into the mental stuff, and breaks it down into as little pieces as he can. And then he says, okay, where's yourself? Is it in the form? If it was in the form, why would forms create suffering? Why would you attach to things? Why would I love this watch and this book so much? and hate this talk so much. I mean, why would I have all this stuff that creates all of these feelings? It makes no sense. So form can't be it, because if it was me, then I would not be separated from it. There would be no chance for what he calls dis-ease or unhealth from it. So, our sense of self is a combination of those five all working together, but they're all interacting constantly. There is no fixed, abiding self. Our lack of ability to control any of those five skandhas shows that it's not us. So if I'm not a fixed, abiding self, if there's nothing permanent about me, what am I? Well, let's kind of take a step back. So one of the big... I'm well aware that I've got at least one philosopher in the room, so I'm going to be careful here. But I think that the sense of self got a lot of impetus from Descartes, who said, "I think, therefore I am. Cogito ergo sum." And so you assume, hey, I think, therefore there must be some fixed self here. There must be a real me here. And then a smartass named Heidegger came along and said, "Okay, Descartes, fine. I think, therefore I am. What does it mean I am? What does it mean to be?" So I'm not saying that you don't exist. I'm not saying that yourself is not. But what I am saying is that you cannot think of it as a fixed thing. And to kind of describe this with another metaphor that the Buddha gave is fire. Another one of his early talks, he said this, bhikkhus or monks, all is burning. And what bhikkhus is the all that is burning? The eye is burning. Forms are burning. Eye consciousness is burning. Eye contact is burning. And whatever feeling arises with eye contact as condition, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of clinging, with the fire of hatred, with the fire of delusion, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair, I say. You know, reading that, you would think the Buddha was really kind of a downer. I mean, he really needs to kind of cheer up a little bit. But I think that's a natural misreading from a lot of years, at least for me, of hearing fire and brimstone sermons. I don't think the Buddha was saying, you're on fire because of your sin, because of your greediness and attachment. I think that he was saying that we think of ourselves as like a rock or something fixed and permanent, but it's much more like fire. It doesn't have a fixed shape. You know, what is fire? I'm sure some physicists could tell me. I really have no idea what fire is, if you ask me, because I don't know if it's solid or gas or whatever. To me, it is just burning. It is the actualization of what it means to burn. Fire to me is just pure burning. It's a pure verb. And it's impacted by what it's fed with. You know, it can grow large if we stoke it. It can grow small if we bank it. It can take many forms, infinite forms. It's never one set fixed thing, but it's always going on, and it's fed. What is it fed by? It's fed by clinging. So, there's no me that is abiding. Even to say that me is a fire is to get it slightly right and slightly wrong. But we are constantly changing, but we think that we're fixed. And so that disconnect between what we actually are and what we think we are causes pain. So let's talk a little bit more about suffering, because that seems a relevant thing to what the Buddha talked about and something that I think we all deal with at some level, to some degree. And you know, before I jump into what the Buddha said about it, let me kind of jump back to, I think, an evolutionary view of it. And that is, if you think about evolution, there's no evolutionary reason why we should be happy. In fact, I think species are much better off if they're somewhat miserable. They're more likely to go find food. They're more likely to go find a mate. They're more likely to survive. Because if you're happy, you're just going to sit back under a tree and ignore and live in life and eventually starve to death or get eaten. But if you're constantly vigilant, if you think, oh man, if I just had one more, you know, piece of meat, if I just, you know, had one more thing, oh man, if I just had one more boyfriend, I would be set. And so you're always wanting. Evolution does not build us for contentment. And part of what evolution did is it said that it rewards those things that work. And one of the things that really works is finding patterns in the world. So if I crawl over the same rock, and every time I crawl over it, there's a predator there, eventually I'm going to figure out, you know what, if I crawl over that rock, that predator is probably going to be there again. And I'm going to make a prediction. If I crawl over that rock, I'm more likely to get eaten than if I stay on this side of the rock. And so from an evolutionary standpoint, it made a lot of sense to find patterns and to make predictions. And if we didn't have those abilities, we wouldn't survive very long. They're wonderful things to have. But they're games, they're tools. They aren't necessarily real. So sometimes our environment changes. Like the bell. The bell is rung, we expect to hear sound. Now, if I got real sneaky and I got a foam bell and I replaced it and Dave struck it, there wouldn't be any sound. And we've all had those situations where we expect something and then it just doesn't happen. And there's two ways that we tend to respond to that. One is we ignore it and we just keep beating that damn bell until it rings. Only it never really does. But eventually we get so much cognitive dissonance, so much tension in our brains that it drives us crazy. Or we can revise our construct and say, usually bells ring, but not that one, or not that time. And so we adapt to our environment. But that also creates stress, because we like things to be predictable, and we don't like to change how we view the world. And if you don't believe that, talk to any politician for more than 2 minutes. Great quote, Norbert Wiener said, "We are patterns that perpetuate themselves. Just as we project onto others and onto other things patterns and predictions, we project those onto ourselves. But in the end, we create patterns for ourselves." And the Buddha also gave a non-evolutionary explanation of suffering, as you would expect, since he, I believe, was before Darwin. He said that suffering comes from clinging. And the Buddha described four types of clinging, but he said, you know, all these other teachings, you know, other people have three of them down flat. I don't really have a whole lot more to say about that, but there's one type of suffering that is different. And that's the self-doctrine clinging. The belief that I am a fixed, abiding self is different than what other people teach. And the word that he used for clinging literally is, it's upadana, and I'm probably slaughtering these, and I'm going between Sanskrit and Pali, so you're going to have to forgive me and look them up yourself. But what I understand is the literal meaning of this word is fuel. So our grasping is the fuel for our suffering, our clinging, our wanting, our attachments. And this sort of clinging, it says, is in three steps. One, we assume that we have a permanent fixed self. That's self-doctrine clinging. Second is wrong view clinging, that we assume that we're either going to live forever or we're going to die. Really the only two options. And if we believe that we may have a soul that lives forever, then we get attached to rites and rituals, called rites and rituals clinging. And we've all seen this. You look at, you know, all the stuff with the Pope today, and all those priests who, you know, ended up taking such refuge in their religion and their spirituality, but never dealt with the real issues. And that's why in our own vows, one of the most precious and central vows is, I will not attach to anything, not even the teachings. So our religion, our own Buddhism, can be a source of suffering and clinging. Or you can take the view of Ecclesiastes, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. It's all going to be over anyway. And so we assume we're going to disappear after this life, and we disregard the next world, and we cling to sense desires. More of everything, more food, more drink, more sex, more everything. And suffering comes from that as well. But all of these come from a sense that there's a permanent fixed self. And because we believe it's permanent, change becomes the enemy. We fall back on those patterns and predictions. We think we live in a world of stable objects that are subject to change. But I don't think that's right. We live in a world of change upon which we project stable objects. Let me say that again because I really like that part. We think we live in a world of stable things subject to change, but we live in a world of change upon which we project a concept of stability. So, how is this relevant to what we're doing tonight? Sitting in Zazen, chanting. Well, it's got to have some relation, because a wonderful monk from Japan, Kodo Suwaki Roshi, known as Homeless Kodo, said, Zazen is the self selfing the self. He stuck a lot of selfs in there, and he stuck it right next to Zazen, so self must have something to do with this Zazen. Here's my guess of what he was talking about. Part of the reason we don't see ourselves as we truly are is that it requires that we let go of those patterns I was talking about. And we have to believe that those patterns are true in some essential way. But to see ourselves as we truly are, as change itself, requires letting go and an acceptance of not knowing. I cannot know right now who I am. I cannot know my own self. I have to accept not knowing, and that is uncomfortable. But in Zazen, at least for me, it becomes easier to accept that confusion and that not knowing. It's like, you know, when I first sat, it was very hard to sit for half an hour without doing this. My knees hurt, my back hurt. And over at some point, I don't even know when, I just started being able to sit longer. And I think the same thing happens mentally. We sit with all this crap, and then finally our brain just sort of gets tired of it and it says, okay, I give up. And a part of that, I think, is that we step, you know, back a little bit, and we can approach all that pain with curiosity. And we can accept the patterns and the lack thereof and the change and say, isn't that interesting? Not go away, I don't like you. One other thing that I think is critical in this and why it's relevant to this practice is another quote by Homeless Kodo. If we imitate a crook's deed right now, we become a crook. If we imitate a Buddha's deed right now, we become a Buddha. Whatever our past was, we should act as a Buddha right now. Right here. This and only this is the true direction of human life. If we see ourselves as fixed and permanent, man, I have a lot of mistakes. And it's okay to acknowledge those mistakes. In fact, we have to, because those build up karma. They build up momentum. They build up all this stuff. And so when the bill collector calls me up, you know, I have to deal with the fact that I didn't pay my bills last month, you know. But at the same time, right now, right here, I have the choice to act like a Buddha or a crook. No matter what my past. And in Zazen, it's the self-selfing the self. It's being present with this so that we can reflect and actually actualize the self right here. Now, I think there's a lot of other tentative thoughts and conclusions, but like I said, you know, this is a short amount of time to deal with a very big topic, and I probably had about twice as many notes that I had to throw out, so I have tried to bring this down to a point as best I could. So there may be some confusion, but I think that I'd like to end with quoting parts of the Genjo Koan, because in looking at it, I realized the whole thing is just about what we're talking about tonight, the self. And it's been screaming it at me for the last, how many 8 years have I been sitting? Almost 20 now. And I never really thought about it this clearly before. So let me just read parts of it. To carry the self forward and illuminate myriad things is delusion. Let me interpret that just as I see it. That is, if I have this concept of self that's fixed and permanent, and I bring that and I say, okay, I'm going to understand the world through this fixed self, I'm deluded. That myriad things come forth and illuminate the self is awakening. So he's not saying the self doesn't exist, but what he's saying is that it's connected with everything, that we are constantly in a dance with the environment around us. Like the air outside my nose that goes into my lungs, that becomes the oxygen in my blood and then is put back out. At some point it becomes me, at some point it isn't me. Is it ever not me? There's not a fixed time when we are separate, and there's not a fixed time when we are the same. But we allow all around us to illuminate us. Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. Further, there are those who continue realizing beyond realization, who are in delusion throughout delusion. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. Now, I take that to say, I really don't like that. I think the word notice there is probably the best you could translate it, but I don't take it in the normal sense. I think what he's saying is that when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they aren't taking themselves so seriously. They aren't creating a self there that is, I am a Buddha, I have realization. They aren't thinking about that. They aren't being a Buddha. They aren't noticing that they're a Buddha because they're just the change. They are actualizing Buddha. They are that flame of Buddha. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddha. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. Well, you know, we cannot study the Buddha way without studying what we're talking about right now. To study the self is to forget the self, to forget that concept of a self that we've got. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains. We forget about that concept of a self. We drop the concept of a fixed self and that of others and other things. And no trace of that realization remains. And then he continues, and this no trace continues endlessly. When you first seek Dharma, you imagine you are far away from its environs. At the moment when Dharma is correctly transmitted, you are immediately your original self. When you ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving, but when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat moves. Similarly, if you examine myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and nature are permanent. When you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self. That is what I have to say. I will let Dogen
give the concluding remarks there. But I would love to hear your thoughts, feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness, all those good things, and help me where we do not have time.
Thank you, Roy. Very good. Yasin?
Yeah, I really enjoyed your talk, Roy. You always do. I've always been really intrigued or somehow taken by this phrase of Dogen's of carrying the self forward. For lots of reasons. I mean, one, that the verb is literally what you do with like a suitcase, like it's baggage. But what was really interesting, what I found interesting in your talk is that it struck me that you were talking about how there's this imposition of you sort of reverse this idea that we there are things and then sometimes they change, but basically there are things. And you said no, it's change. And out of this, we constellate a world of things. And I'm just really struck, or sort of considering for the first time that phrase of Dogen's, which that thing of carrying forward the self. I mean, it sounds like it may be exactly that process of going out and stamping everything in such a way that it sort of will help this support this misapprehension of a of permanence of selfhood. So anyway, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we what's the term, reify? We try and make concrete things that are not. And the saying, you never step into the same river twice, we find patterns and that's useful. And if you want to find where the Mississippi is, it's good to look on a map and, it will probably be pretty much where the map says it was. But that doesn't mean that there is a Mississippi.
We can't actually even get so far as to know that we can't step into the same river twice, because the way that's sort of postulated is that you will go back, but the river will be different. But you can't get that far because you actually can't go back in the way that's in the picture.
Can you step in the same river once?
Well, that's a different thing. Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I know you can't do it twice, but there is stepping in rivers, that much we are. Seriously?
Yeah, I think there is a river. It's just not what we think of as the river in our common way of thinking.
Other comments or questions for Roy or responses? Adam.
What practices do you utilize when you're in circumstances where self is not easily understood the way you usually perceive yourself, or something is questioning your usual way, and instead of reacting in the way that usually would, you allow, and there's, as you were saying, it's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how do you practice with that uncomfortableness so something new or fresh is possible?
For me personally, it's by making the same mistake a lot of times. Had a conversation, and I could probably put that in quotes, with a friend who was not having her best day. And she kind of was trying to get me to get into a fight, basically, because I was not making her happy. And I remembered all of the really horrible relationships I'd had in my life where, you know, I had taken the bait. And so I have taken the bait so many times and had so many things thrown at me and gotten caught up in anger and attachment so easily. And so finally you just kind of get to a place where it's, oh, I've seen this before. And I think that's what Zazen is about, especially, you know, the Shikan Taza, where you're just there and present. And that's been my sort of background. And through time, I'm doing more, you know, metta meditations of different types. But I think there's some real value in doing the, at least for a time, the Shikan Taza, where you are just there and present and watching stuff come up. Because it gives you some skills in daily life of, oh, this is coming up. Oh, there's anger. Hello, old friend. Oh, there's impatience. Oh, there's loneliness. And just bringing curiosity. Oh, okay, well, where does this impact me? And sometimes you can even go so far as to say, well, you know, this is about not just me, it's about the other person as well. So I wonder what's going on with them and where they're at. And maybe I can actually speak to their situation. And sometimes it will be, you know, taking a step back and saying, okay, what's going on? What's really going on here? And sometimes they're past that, and so you just, you know, run for the door. But, you know, realizing it's not just you either. I don't know if that answers your question at all. But...
No, I think, yeah, that was helpful. Thank you.
Time for maybe one more comment or response or question. Yes, Bill.
Do you understand systems theory very well after reading that the Joanna Macy book?
I think she gives a really good introduction to it. And I read it, here's my confession for the day. I read this quite a while back, and then I kind of went back into it where it was talking about these particular issues of self. You're asking me kind of, you know, what I don't know. So all I know about it is basically from her book and maybe, you know, bits here and there. So you can judge my ignorance and maybe judge her. I wouldn't judge her book. But I think it's an excellent book. And it does a very nice job of kind of setting up the systems theory and the Buddhist theory and seeing the interactions there and the consistencies there.
And is the idea in system? I don't know much about systems theory, but is the idea that there are interconnections among all things and codependent arising is similar to?
Yeah, how I took it was this, and this is probably a longer conversation than the time we have, but. She gives an example and that I think is a good one, is that, let me first say that she does not take an atomistic view of the world. And so systems theory is saying you're not just this thing here, that you are related to everything around you. So let's take the example of a person cutting down a tree. She's got the axe, she hits the tree, and then the tree responds. And that tree is constantly changing based on how she's cutting it down. But she's constantly changing how she's cutting the tree based on what happens with the wood. So the tree is influencing how she's acting. And beyond that, it's actually influencing her because her neurons in her brain are constantly changing to adapt to that tree. And so that is sort of a microcosm for all of us, that we adapt to our environment. So, like, if when I grew up in my family, I did certain things, and my family knew, okay, you know, beating your brother in the head, that gets you a negative response.
you know, smiling and saying nice things about other people, that gets you a positive response. And so I responded to that, but then I also did actions to respond to them. So it's not a fixed thing. It's not just them influencing me. I influence my family, and my family responds and influences me, to which I respond, and they respond, and there's this constant circle of actions and interactions and reactions, so that it's impossible to look at any one thing without looking at the broader connections and relationships.